Welcome to another episode of New Books and Poetry. I am your host, John Ebersole, and I'm delighted to be joined by the poet and critic William Logan. William Logan's most recent book of verse is Madam X, published by Penguin, and he has a forthcoming book of criticism coming out soon called Guilty Knowledge, Guilty Pleasure from Columbia University Press. William Logan, welcome.
John, pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure having you. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time, and I've been reading your work for a real long time. What number book is this? This is like your 11th book, is it?
I can't say I've kept count. I think it's perhaps the 9th plus a selected.
That's right. Yeah.
So who knows?
Yeah. Let me ask you right off the bat. How have you, kind of looking back over that course of time, have your priorities changed as a poet about, you know, the content you cover, or what changes have you noticed in your sensibility as a poet?
Well, I try not to notice those changes as much as possible. I'm not the sort of poet who thinks this book is a project and it has its own arc and its own drama or melodrama. I write a poem and then I write another poem, and maybe if I'm lucky, I write a poem after that. I don't really plan these things out. I don't think that's a virtue. I don't think it's a vice. But whatever my constitution is, it's such that I think about local matters more than anything else. However, I will admit that once and once only, I did get into a position where I thought, well, I could make a whole book of sequences on Venice, which became Macbeth and Venice.
Yeah.
So I'm not completely immune to the idea, though in general I find project books disappointing.
Yeah, I wonder why poets are just drawn to them. Like, what is the attraction to them? Is it that they feel just a intense need to publish, you think? Or,
well, the grapevine, I'm told, says that publishers are more susceptible to the idea of a project.
Oh, that's interesting.
I try to dissuade my students from this idea because what I say is that if you have a project, even a good project, you write the first three poems, but the project then writes you.
Yeah. And
you're in the bad position for a poet of just fulfilling an idea rather than feeling in some small way inspired by a line or a rhythm or a word and going on and doing something with it.
Yeah, it is kind of that weird difference of like having a set project and some sort of like idea of an outcome versus kind of the inspired poem, you know. It kind of has always struck me where you've mentioned the classroom you're at University of Florida, that's right?
Indeed.
And how long have you been there?
This is 31st year, not counting years off, years off in England.
That's
for
amazing.
Sabbatical or leave or something.
31 years. So how did you originally, God, Florida's changed. Maybe it hasn't changed all that much. How'd you end up there?
This is North Florida. We don't change very much up here. We have our gators and we have our swamps and we don't have a lot of construction. It's a bigger town than it was in the early 80s when Deborah and I moved here,
yeah.
But it's not unrecognizable at all.
Yeah, because I grew up right outside of Orlando in this town called Winter Park. And so many of my friends after high school went to U of S, and I visited Gainesville often. So I'm very familiar with the town. How did you in particular end up there?
In 83, Deborah and I had been living in England for 2 years on an Amy Lowell poetry traveling scholarship, as it was called, which is essentially a fellowship, not for very much money, but enough to keep us abroad for a while. And toward the end of that second year, we were applying for jobs in the States. One of the ones I applied to was here at UF. I had been recommended for the position, as had half a dozen or a dozen others, by Donald Justice, who had been here just a year. And they were looking for somebody who would come in as a younger poet, but someone who could also direct the creative writing program.
Wow, that's exciting. And clearly, 31 years later, you must have been pretty happy with it. So it's interesting because in your work, you're always kind of, I don't know if you're wrestling with Florida or just kind of, or you, I don't know. I sense that you have an intimate knowledge of it and at the same time are able to kind of look at it objectively. How have you I'm always curious about anybody who spent more than like a month in Florida, because it's such a strange place to me. You know, how have you felt just living in the state with the prettiest name?
Well, I don't think it knows it has the prettiest name. It has so many problems. Any state that doesn't have a state income tax has a lot of problems. Hmm. And financially, it's a state that is in many ways at the top of the ranks of the South, only because it has a sales tax and a hell of a lot of tourists.
Yeah,
it's got ferocious problems of poverty and you know, cultural poverty as well. However, it's a very beautiful state, and Bishop, though she lived at the other end of it, was absolutely right that it is one of the prettiest states. Outside. Sorry?
Oh, no, go ahead.
I just was going to say, you can go from my house into swamp, and what we call prairie, which is a kind of marshy prairie, in about 11 minutes.
Yeah, that's incredible.
We're close. We're close to nature.
Yeah. And,
like it or not.
You're pretty close to the Ocala National Forest, I guess. No?
Reasonably close. About 10 years ago, they caught a small bear that had come out of the Ocala Forest and was in our neighborhood.
That's hilarious. So, I mean, do you like Florida?
I do like Florida. It took about 10 years to like it. I think that I was all too willing to get out. I thought I might be here about 5 years. I liked Donald quite a lot, and I liked the department, and I liked the students. All of that was fine.
Yeah.
But I didn't like Florida so much in the beginning. It was too hot and too southern and too much mired in old ways. The hamburger joint we loved, which closed down a few years ago, mm-hmm. Was called Louie's Lunch and served these 1920s style hamburgers.
Huh.
But not 10 years before it had still been segregated. People forget that the South was segregated in all sorts of ways until the 70s.
Yeah, I remember my own mother telling me, like, must have been in the late 70s, that a department store we were in one day, you know, and she pointed out, like, absolutely remembering, you know, the separate water fountains and bathrooms.
Yep.
And Florida is such a transient state, and people don't think of it as like having a culture, I guess. But you're right, it is actually, despite some like urban centers, it's steeped in kind of a southern culture. And I don't know, some people don't consider it the South, but my encounter with it has been, that's very much the South. And the climate, it's so one dimensional. I think that's when I moved up north, it was just amazing. I didn't even know the order of the seasons for a long time in my childhood living in Florida. It was really incredible. But I just wanted to say, because you talk about the natural beauty of Florida, and I was visiting recently this weekend, and in Central Florida, there's so much commercial activity, and the landscape is so flat that there doesn't seem to be anything to stop it, and there's nothing worth almost preserving from history, it seems like. And what it does, in my experience, is it kind of throws a blanket over its very unique natural beauty. Mm. And I find that tension constantly now when I revisit there. It's that, whether it's the cypress trees or the marshes and the prairies that you mentioned and the alligators, and just the whole exotic landscape gets kind of just eclipsed by this, the kind of extremity of the place, commercially, and the human activity of it. But anyway, so before you were in Gainesville, you did your MFA at Iowa. That's correct, right?
I was at Iowa in the early 70s.
Yeah, what was that experience like?
I liked Iowa City. It was a wonderful place to be in graduate school, a small town, one where you couldn't escape very easily to a larger city and distract yourself.
Right.
Don Justice, who was my teacher there and who was my colleague here for 10 years, once said at the beginning of an interview with a young fiction writer, he said, well, I think you ought to know the first thing about Florida and the University of Florida and Gainesville is it's boring here. We all looked, I think, very uncomfortable. There was a long beat, and then Don says, but for a writer, that can be a good thing.
Right. And so you've been there for 31 years. I know, I always read in your biography that you also live in London as well. Can you tell me about
Cambridge.
Yeah.
Cambridge.
Yeah. Well, how did that all kind of unfold in your life?
Deborah Gregor, my wife, that's hard to think of her as my wife because we were just sweethearts for 36 years before we finally got married.
When did you get married?
2009, I want to say.
Oh, wow.
But I'm a little vague on the date at this point. But I can still scarcely believe it.
That is incredible. All right, go ahead.
So we were in Cambridge on an Amy Lowell fellowship in 1981. We had emerged from Iowa City. She got out of the workshop the year before I did. We came out of Iowa City in 1975. Deborah had 2 years at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown and a year teaching at George Mason and 2 years teaching at Chico. After that, she had a Radcliffe Fellowship, but I had won this Amy Lowell, and the Amy Lowell people were kind enough to put it on hold for a year.
Oh,
so
nice.
we ended up in England, and as we didn't know England very well, I'd been there once years before. We decided we wanted to live in a university town, and in an English-speaking country. So England and Cambridge or Oxford, we pretty much flipped a coin. It was Cambridge, which was probably the right choice. Cambridge was a very different kind of town from Oxford, not nearly so developed and not nearly so trafficked. Mm-hmm. And there we were.
Yeah. And how do you, what are some of the comparisons to, I don't know why, but it seems like polar opposites to go from there to Florida and kind of working those two locations. How does your disposition or mood or like, how do you change between those two locations?
I suppose when you're first making trips to a country that has different culture or different standards or different habits, it is strange at first for some weeks or months. In Britain, you have to watch where the traffic is coming from at first. Mm-hmm. And you have to figure out the money. You have to figure out how to speak. It's very difficult on the phone for somebody to understand not the words of an American, but the intonations. And you have to lift your voice at different parts of the sentence in order to make it more comprehensible
right.
to the average Brit. There's all of that. But you know, once you've done it five or six times, you go on automatic, the way people do who know a second language well.
Right.
You can shift back and forth without even thinking about it. And so at this point, it's a matter of taking a suitcase over, opening up the closets in our house, they're getting out our stuff, and then we just start. It's no transition at all because a Gainesville winter is like an English summer. We're suffering either two English summers or two Florida winters.
Exactly. And do your work habits change at all? I mean, is Florida kind of more geared towards, you know, busy work and then England is more kind of a time to relax? Or, I mean, it's just the way you're describing it is almost just William Logan is the same person everywhere he goes. You know, like,
well, I hope that's true, I think. I would say that the main advantage to moving so sharply once a year or twice, because we come back, of course,
yeah.
is that you clear your desk.
Mm.
You yeah. put all the stuff away. You take over a few files and a laptop, and you start over again. And in a week or two, of course, everything is messed up. But I don't think it's a bad thing for a writer to have to put things away once in a while.
Yeah, and I guess so, this rhythm is totally ingrained by now.
It is. We've done it so often. We've been over there for the summer for the past 20, 21 years, and we've had five or six long stays of 15 months. So we're bicontinental, I suppose, without feeling any more sophisticated for that.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you real quick. I'm not married to a poet. I'm married to a poet lover, but have you any observations about being now married to a poet and living with a poet? I mean, is it just kind of a silly question?
I don't think it's a silly question. It's a question often asked, and I suppose it's often asked because people presume that there must be some kind of antagonism or jealousy when two writers work together.
Or maybe like a deep camaraderie, you know?
Well, I think it's closer to that than any jealousy. I remember in the late 70s, we'd been together two or three years and it had applied to all sorts of stuff.
Right.
And Deborah had certainly gotten things I hadn't and I'd gotten things that she hadn't. But there was a moment when she won her first NEA and I was jealous for about 24 hours. And then, you know, I thought, well, it's kind of a win for us both.
Yeah.
And I suspect that any honor either of us has had the same reaction from the other, that we're, you know, we're not partners of a terrible word, but we're collaborating, or we're joined at the hip, or we're hitched, which is a metaphor for rope. One lover used to call another lover, amusingly, old rope. We're used to it, and it's productive in that we read each other's work, and we can scribble on it the way nobody else would be allowed to.
I was going to ask you about that. Just like having that one trusted reader must be incredible. Where is the rest of your family? Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Boston in 1950. In a lower, I suppose, a lower middle class housing development. My dad was a salesman for Alcoa. Hmm. He'd come out of the war. He was a Navy radio man on a ship that ran mail to Iceland.
Really?
And it was not a glorious war. It was not a bad war. He came out without a scratch and went to college on the GI Bill, went to Yale, which he'd flunked out of before he entered the Navy, and took a degree in engineering. But after the war, salesman seemed like the right job, and he was that, and then an executive for a number of years with Alcoa, a small boating firm on Long Island, and then boating parts firm, and then Con Edison, and then in his 50s went into real estate with my mom.
And you saw family all still in Boston. Do you have siblings?
I have siblings. I have three brothers and a sister. We lived, aside from Boston, we lived in Westport, Massachusetts, which is down on the coast near New Bedford. We lived in Pittsburgh. We lived on Long Island when I was in high school. And that's pretty much where my folks stayed until my dad died. And my mom moved to Florida for the last years of her life. My siblings, my sister's employed as a caregiver and other things on Long Island. My brother Pete's a lawyer in Marin County. My brother Dave is a lawyer in San Diego. My brother Jim makes boats near the Hudson.
Oh, wow. Do you know anything about boat making?
No, I don't know much about boat making. I like boats, but boat making, that's beyond my purview.
And this is probably a weird question. I don't know. How did poetry find you? I mean, how did you find poetry? Is this something where you like were, or let me ask you this, in the family culture you were in, did you visually see as a child people reading often? Like, was that an image that you were always kind of exposed to? What was kind of like your introduction to just the, you know, reading and writing?
Well, yeah, wouldn't that be nice if one came from a family where War and Peace was thrown at you every day until you read it? My folks read, but they read Book of the Month Club books. They were not massive readers.
Sure.
They had genial middle class tastes and a genial or more than genial middle class income. But I was a reader from before I could read. I pretended to read by memorizing books I had been read. Which I suppose is the way a lot of young readers who like the idea of reading begin. I still have I don't know what it is, a page or a note card or something from high school where I was trying to read a book a day.
Oh my
but
God.
The books you could read in a day if you had other things, because I had a minor interest in sports, were generally popular books.
Yeah.
And so I had to slow down in order to read anything that was worth reading. As for poetry, I had the usual crappy high school introduction to it.
Yeah.
Which is generally poems written by 19th century women with three names.
Oh my God.
Horrible things. and high school English is indeed fairly dire, or at least
right.
was then. But I confess, I had the chance to be in the AP English class in my high school. I received a handwritten invitation from the teacher who had done this course for 25 years and had invited me to join the Peacock Club.
What was that?
Well, that was what it was called. She called her AP class the Peacock Club.
Oh, nice.
And I stood by my mailbox and looked at this thing, and I thought, the one thing I can't do is join the Peacock Club. So one of many academic mistakes I made was not to take the AP course in English and to have a probably much worse course with my friends. Poetry, I'm not sure how poetry found me. The just so story is that I, in the 11th grade, I think, was angry with my folks one evening and scribbled a poem about them or against them. That's a miserable, terrible poem, I'm sure. But it did give me a taste for something that was like poetry. When I got to college, I took a few writing workshops without learning a thing. I don't say the teachers were bad. One was a rather good teacher, who was a Yale Younger Poet, but they didn't have the key to unlock whatever I had, meager though it must have been.
Yeah. And where did you go to do your undergraduate work?
I was at Yale.
You were at Yale. And we have been talking off air momentarily. Is that where you met Richard Howard for the first time?
It is indeed.
Yeah,
Oh,
go ahead.
Well, my senior year, I had two workshops in the last semester. One was poetry and one was nominally fiction. Richard Howard taught the poetry class. It was the second course he'd ever taught. He'd been back from France for a year or so, where he'd been employed as a lexicographer. Mm-hmm. And so it was all new to him. And he was really, from the start, an extraordinary teacher. He didn't conduct a workshop the way workshops are normally conducted. He just engaged in a wonderful, brilliant monologue about poetry. He would read us people like Bishop, and he would talk about poetry. And then after 2 hours, he'd give us an assignment, which we'd do, turn in the next week. And the week after that, he'd read aloud the one he liked best and maybe a stanza or so from a couple that he liked a little. And that was it. We never saw the poems again.
That's incredible, because I don't know. I teach once in a while some undergraduate workshops, and sometimes I don't have an idea what I'm doing in there. So it's interesting that he would just pick out a couple things that some people have written, but the main thrust of the course was, look, I know a lot, and I'm going to tell you guys what I know, and hopefully that'll inspire you. And that was your senior year?
Well, yeah, but I wouldn't have put it quite that way. I would say, here's somebody who had written a fair amount of poetry, a lot of it pretty interesting, mm-hmm. and who loved poetry. And he was just so overfull with emotion about it, yeah. that he wanted to share it with students. I never had the feeling from Richard that he ever talked down to us. He might have laughed, I suppose, if we said something that was perfectly idiotic, yeah. but we weren't really asked to say anything. So it was conducted as a wonderful monologue.
No, that is fantastic. And so was it a no-brainer for you to pursue the MFA?
It wasn't a no-brainer. I knew about the third week into Richard's class that what he was asking me to do in his assignments were things that I had never understood could be done by me in poems. And the key insight for me was that all of the ingenuity I had expended on math and science and even as an undergrad in some graduate courses in probability and statistics, all of that could be done with language.
Right.
That language was essentially problem solving. You just had to set yourself a problem. The imagination responds to difficulty and to being asked to do things it hasn't done before.
Exactly.
I don't use Richard's assignments, but I use assignments with my students that ask them to do such things. So to get back to the, you know, to the story of the foundation of all of this, such as it is, the second class I had was a fiction class, though I was allowed to write poetry because I had proposed the class, and the teacher knew that I didn't really have a lot of interest in doing fiction. So he was glad for me to write poetry. It was another monologue. This was a very young teacher. He was 25. He was apparently the highest scoring Yale student ever on the final English exam, which by the time I was there a few years later was not being offered. And he was a great favorite of Robert Penn-Warren and Cleanthes Brooks, two of the leading lights of the English department at that time. This guy was astonishing. He was he was probably the only true genius I met as a student. And he had an ability to talk off the cuff without notes about a Faulkner book, or We Did Light in August, or Fitzgerald, or Hemingway, or any of the other standards, or even something of an oddity like Richard Yates's Revolutionary Road.
Right.
He would give a brilliant hour lecture on this. It was supposed to be a 2-hour class, and he'd look at his watch, and once he went an hour and 10 minutes and held the watch up in triumph, but it was really more than about 50 minutes. That was about what he could do.
That's interesting. I wonder if a professor, you know, these professors clearly didn't feel guilty about just kind of going on with such enthusiasm. And I think, I don't know, I'm sure this has happened to you in the classroom where I guess I've wondered, like, wait. And your story tells me that the students do respond positively to that kind of enthusiasm. But I think I doubt myself sometimes. But I interrupted you. So this was like a prelude, kind of. These are the kind of formative experiences that were kind of leading up to the decision to pursue an MFA. Yeah.
And so the fiction class taught me all sorts of things, because this was his angle. About how the form of the story, the direction of the story, can test the characters in various ways and put them in positions from which they have to make, say, a moral or ethical decision or something that creates drama and pathos or disaster or whatever. He thought through these things very carefully and was just extraordinary at being able to articulate them mm-hmm. to a bunch of kind of rough and ready Yale students. Now, he had gone to Iowa himself a few years before and had had a somewhat checkered career there. He had left after his first year to do some script writing in Hollywood on Peyton Place, that old soap opera that was on about four nights a week. And he eventually finished his Iowa degree. He was nominally a novelist. He'd done about the first part of what was to be a trilogy about the effect on a family of the death of their youngest son. And I read some of these chapters as they'd appeared in literary magazines. And what impressed me was that in dialogue, he was just amazing. He was an extraordinary writer of dialogue. He had a ways to go with the narrative parts. Those were not quite as sophisticated, but the dialogue was just brilliant. And in the course of time, he was drawn out to Hollywood and became became a writer on Hill Street Blues, and then the creator of NYPD Blue and Deadwood and Luck. His name is David Milch.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing! And so after that, you headed off to Iowa, and then almost it seems like the rest of history. That was in the 70s too. And now, when you're in the classroom and you're teaching, you've been doing this so long now. What are you finding in your students that you think need the most attention in their work?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not a monologuist, though. When I'm answering questions from an interviewer, apparently I can go on a bit. In general, the way I like to run a classroom is that I will give a few comments on a poem, and then students will comment, and I will react to their comments if I think it's necessary, which much of the time it may be. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in seeing how they can turn what is just raw imagination into something that is a poem worth reading. And so we have to attend at the highest level to uses of language, development of discourse in mm-hmm. some fashion, and also the formal problems that a poem might or might not present. We do a little bit of meter. I generally teach meter for about 3 or 4 weeks and then do a couple of poems in meter, though that's mostly to train their ear so that when they read Pope or Milton or Shakespeare, they know something about what the poet thought he was doing.
Right.
As far as their poems are concerned, well, at the lowest level, it's correcting grammatical mistakes, which they need, alas, because American high schools are afraid of teaching grammar and have been for about 40 years.
Yeah.
And I think that's unfortunate, because it means that I have to be an eighth grade grammar teacher as much as anything else. And I am not an eighth grade grammar teacher, and I don't want to be an eighth grade grammar teacher.
And are these mostly, these are just straight graduate students, right?
No, I'm talking about the undergrads.
Oh, you did? I wasn't sure if you taught undergrad.
Oh, yeah. Better. No, one of the great virtues, I think, of the University of Florida is that the way our academic schedule is constructed, we teach one graduate course a year, and we teach, if we're full-time, we teach 3 undergraduate courses.
Do you find any difference between the whole vibe in the classroom and the work being produced between the undergraduates and the graduates?
Oh, sure. Of course, the courses are different, but it's an interesting difference. The undergrads have a lot of raw imagination that's never been tapped before.
Exactly. Yeah.
And by the time they get to me, unless it's an honors class, in which case I'm pretty much getting them straight from the docs, I'm facing students who have had one or two or three workshops already, sometimes with another, one of them will be with another graduate prof, but they also have courses with my MFA students. And they get a certain way so that they have a certain amount of sophistication by they come, by the time they come in. But still you're dealing with raw undergraduate imagination, and you have to show them the sorts of things they might be able to do, which I think you can do using assignments faster than you can do in about any other way.
Yeah, definitely. And so I want to kind of, since the show is called New Books in Poetry, I do want to turn to Madam X. And I was wondering if you wanted to speak to did this manuscript and this book come about as most of your others have? Was there anything unique about how this one came into existence?
I can't think of one unique thing about it. It's a collection of poems written over a certain time. I didn't collect all of them. I might have one or two that are from some period a year before or some month after where the body of them are from. But either I have no gift for conceiving of books as some part of some master plan, the whole harmonium to use Stevens's term, or I just prefer to think of these as collections, not structured any better than one would construct any number of poems that one was faced by anybody else. You would in a way that made them feel part of a whole.
Definitely. And so I was hoping we can open up and read a few of these, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I wanted to ask real quick, because I was talking to James Loganbach about this, because he writes quite a bit of prose as well as poetry. When you're writing prose, is that pretty much something you do between poems? I mean, have you kind of worked out this kind of pendulum between producing prose and I almost speak for myself. It's like when I'm not, because like you, I think you write poems as they kind of organically occur to you and are inspired to pen them, where, you know, writing a review is kind of like an assignment that you can kind of just dig right into. Are you just kind of seamlessly writing poetry and prose, or is there like a clear demarcation between those?
Well, it's not seamless. It's hard to describe, because I don't think that there's any particular rule to it. Mm-hmm. There are certainly times when I can write poems and criticism in concert in some way. But there are also times when writing the one is intense enough that it begins to block the other. And so I haven't written a lick of poetry. I haven't even looked at my summer manuscript since I've been back. Hmm. In Florida. We're now in early October, so it's about 6 weeks of not even thinking about poems particularly.
Right.
On the other hand, I've had periods just as long when I wasn't thinking about criticism. I do them as necessity dictates.
Exactly.
About the...
That makes total sense. I was hoping you can read, you can start us off with the poem, Madam X.
Sure. Visitors scarcely glance at her now as they pass by. I imagine a half-audible sigh escaping her pursed and self-confiding lips, like the thrum of certain stately ships that, having weighed anchor, never come to port. Her feelings, no doubt, were of the finer sort. In modesty's immodesty, she averts her gaze through the crackled oil's concealing haze, a woman who touched up her ears with lavender powder, her skin the shade of Delmonico's clam chowder, the waist pinched narrow as a wasp, not cinched tight until you could hear her gasp, her dress exposing in cold décolletage the alpine and slow breasts, which were briefly the rage. Hers was sometimes called a professional beauty, which implies a certain impersonal duty to a beauty evanescent as morning vapor. The painter thought her face like blotting paper. You can see, alas, how it would end. Those who rise so high rarely have grace to descend. A century on, my students' low-cut jeans have the effect of a match on gasoline, flaunting like a cold slice of mutton, a naked 4 inches below the belly button. A strip of flesh that asks the old question, is nothing more sexual than a taste for suggestion? Or Madame X in her day was far bolder. Originally, the right strap had slipped off her shoulder.
All right. Thanks so much for that. When you have a poem that you name the book after, is that a special decision? I'm getting the sense that you're going to tell me, like, I'm getting the sense that this is not a big decision for you, and you're like, I don't know. Is there anything behind naming the book this? Because I mean, the poem is taking this position of like, suddenly, the piece of artwork is gazing at the gazers, you know, and I don't know. Why'd you title the book Madam X after this poem?
I don't get very anxious about those things. I think most of my titles have arrived at some point, seemed about the best I could do, and got put at the head of the manuscript. I rarely second guess those things, and I rarely try to make some sort of calculated decision about what I need or the market needs or the book.
You know, William, don't you know it's supposed to be like this major philosophical decision to naming a manuscript after?
I'm sure it is for many people, but I lack that philosophical gene, I think.
Well, it's interesting because you do have this kind of disposition of kind of like, and it's funny when I interview younger poets, I mean, they're like, this is like serious, like business. And it's not that you're not serious, but that your seriousness is channeled into, you know, kind of that, look, I've made this poem, I've made it, and here it is. And you don't attach any kind of spectral kind of values to it.
No.
And I really, it's kind of refreshing to hear. The poem is after, you know, that portrait. How'd you come across that portrait? And it seems to be that the poem, you know, is kind of, and throughout the book, you seem at times to be kind of, you know, always kind of noticing the evolution of like immodesty and sexual immodesty in our culture and kind of pushing it against how things were in the past. Can you talk about that in any way?
Well, I came across the painting. It's a famous painting by John Singer Sargent, now hanging at the Met. I must have come across it at some point and been struck by it. And perhaps in the back of my mind, it eventually associated itself with the issue, that the poem eventually comes to, which is that that Madame X in the late 19th century was an outsider figure for having been painted with a strap coming off her dress, which to us would seem like a minor faux pas, something that might happen during a Super Bowl halftime.
Precisely.
But in this case, it caused a huge ruckus because it suggested that there was a body beneath the dress and that one might take off the dress and do God knows what with it. Sargent eventually, as the poem says, painted the strap back on.
Yeah.
But it the idea lingers that the modes and mores of culture are very changeable. So that the bare breasts of one century become the extraordinarily covered breasts of another century. And yet, whenever you have a mode of fashion, there will usually be some way of signaling sexuality, whether it's just the uncovered ankle of the Victorians, as we're often told, or just complete nudity. We're daily, I don't want to say assaulted with, maybe delighted by. I don't know. But the poem wants at some point to touch, since I'm now in my 60s, that feeling that one has when one looks at undergraduates and sees them at the beginning of their lives, intellectually and sexually, and sees the various ways in which they signal to their peers that they're physical.
Right.
And you may recall that in the middle of the last decade, a lot of female undergraduates were wearing extraordinarily short jeans that were buttoned about 4 inches below the belly button and had extraordinarily short blouses that generally ended along around the bottom of the breast. So there was a lot of skin being shown for about 4 or 5 years. And then one day it was over.
Right.
Fashion moved on.
Yeah, it's interesting how it is kind of has its finger on the pulse of kind of the sensibility of a culture. But I mean, it's funny because you brought up undergraduates and just working on a campus, especially, you don't probably see it as much in Gainesville now, but you've been on other college campuses, that transition from winter to spring, those first like couple warm days of spring on a campus is like just an explosion of flesh, and it's like startling. It's like, oh my gosh, people aren't wearing clothes anymore on campus. And
you see that in England sometimes, in even in the cold days of May, you'll get off a train and see people coming from London up to Cambridge to do clubbing, or coming from Cambridge down to London to do clubbing. But they're all on the platform, young women basically in 90s.
Right.
And high heels. And you think, don't they know it's 45 degrees outside?
I know, it's incredible.
But of course they do know. They do know.
Yeah, they're quite aware of it. Yeah. And do you have any sort of theory on, do you think these things just ebb and flow, or are we like, what do you attribute anything to, like, kind of the hypersexualization of young people?
No, I don't. I think that fashions of this sort gain ground and lose ground. My students are bewildered when I tell them that it was most unusual for an undergraduate in the late 60s, early 70s, an undergraduate woman to wear a bra.
Right.
They find this deeply shocking. And indeed, I know that one of my students was complaining mildly to a friend last semester because another young woman in the class wasn't wearing a bra, even though you really couldn't tell and I hadn't noticed.
Right.
What they're shocked by is not necessarily what their mothers were shocked by.
Yeah, that puts one in just a humbling position of, having kind of strong, kind of opinions about this kind of surface cultural phenomenon. I was hoping we could move on to page 25, where we find Mrs. Custer in Washington City.
Sure.
And I wanted to ask you real quick before you started, what is, I did a little background on this. Can you tell us real quick why you chose September 1864? Because my understanding that there was this like strange gap in the research I was looking at, I don't know. She got married in 62? No, 66? I don't know.
No. She was married in the middle of the Civil War.
What was the significance of this date? Why'd you pick it?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
Oh, what was the significance of September 1864, which is right below the title of the poem?
It was merely the date in which the original letter was written. Both the letters in this pair of Custer poems, one by her, one by him, were based on actual letters, and I adjusted them to make them into syllabic poems.
Okay, so that's all. That's great. Go ahead.
So there was no overriding thought about it, except that they seemed to be interesting letters and to convey something of the personalities of this very interesting Custer, very interesting couple. The Custers were really extraordinary in some ways. George was one of the major generals in the Civil War. He was the most courageous and brilliant cavalry commander in the army, mm-hmm. and won a lot of crucial battles. He then, like most army officers who wanted to stay in the army after the Civil War, was demoted. You had to accept a much lower rank because there just wasn't room for a lot of generals.
Right. Yeah.
And so he went from he was a major general in the volunteers, I think, and a brigadier general in the army, or vice versa, and he became a lieutenant colonel in the 7th Cavalry. So they were extraordinary in that they had chosen this army career. And like most other army couples of the time, they lived together out in this case, in the plains. They lived together, and she accompanied him on various expeditions. In fact, wanted to come with him on what became the expedition ending in the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
I know. That's what I read, that she would accompany him on these missions. I was amazed. It was incredible.
Well, they were both good writers, and his book about his life out there is a very reasonable, very good book. It's not as good as, say, Grant's memoirs, but it's a very good book. She's a wonderful writer. She's much better than he is. And her three books about their army experiences are really classics of American travel literature.
Hmm. Yeah. That's
so
amazing. Yeah,
Mrs. Custer in Washington City. My darling, this is the saddest city, the maimed and bandaged soldiers mobbing the streets, slow moving government hearses pass. The black coffins wrapped in the flag these boys died for. Painted establishments embalming the dead are planted on each corner. Old Mr. K stopped here last night, most cordial, too much so, for I had to avoid his bold attempt to kiss me by gripping a chair. This city is a Sodom, crowded with sin, by day as well as by night. Small bands of ragged secessionists still weave through our half-rebel city, yet there is a fine show of patriotism. Our flag stretches across the street on the darkies parade, dressed in bold and gaudy hues, unused to liberty, in proud procession, faces tinted pale to sooty black. Their babies have beady eyes and black woolly heads. They're all so good, I never heard one cry. All the avenues filled with gilded sin, some girls wearing their dresses suspiciously long. Even though I despise a veil, I might as well live in Turkey, for I dare not go out alone without one. My lodging house sits between a Lincoln flag, I'm quite a Lincoln girl, and a banner with McClellan's name. As soldiers pass, they raise a cheer for McClellan and groan for poor Lincoln, or just the reverse. The president, that great soul, is the gloomiest, most painfully careworn man I ever saw. If McClellan were elected, that would mean peace. Dishonest peace, perhaps. Audie, I want peace on any terms. It may be unwomanly, much as I love my country. I love you more. Why must your brigade do everything? My canary notepaper says I'm cavalry. I have trimmed a hat with cavalry yellow. Your dear little army crow, Libby.
That was great. And, you know, as we immediately, just visually, the poem, you know, we were talking about Richard Howard and how, and you mentioned that this poem was written in syllabics that he is, you know, so known for. What was it? What do you think of that restraint as you're working in it? Do you find it that it's more conducive to like the monologue or the letter writing kind of poem? What was your experience with kind of taking this on?
It's a good question. I've certainly written syllabic poems that are not monologues, that are say meditative. And I've written poems that like this one had as their source, say a letter. I've done one for Lewis Carroll, these two, and I did one that I think has been published only in magazines, by my grandfather's second wife writing to my dad. There may be something about the way the material is already there that lets one shape it a little more easily than one might shape something that you're generating out of your own imagination. I'm not sure. I don't do it all that often, but it does seem to me a form that's sneaked in to my poems.
Yeah, I mean, it's such
go ahead.
I was just gonna say it's such a rigid kind of restriction to put on oneself that isn't entirely kind of making any sort of nods to, you know, the essential music. I'm wondering, you know, what is the impulse to write in that kind of restriction? I mean, I've written syllabics and I like counting, you know, I just find it interesting since it's not like, you know, you're not going da-dum, da-dum, da-dum or anything. It is very much, and the poem as it cascades down the page does have this like jumpy visual quality to it, I think, that is really nice. But anyway, maybe I'm just kind of looking at it too hard.
No, I think one could look at it a little harder, and I think one would say that for the writer, there's the contrast between the fluidity of the original, that one writes a letter without thought, as to its margins. It's a prose medium.
Right.
A tension between the fluidity of the writing and the possible restrictions that the syllabic form throws up. So it's a puzzle. It's a puzzle to be worked out. And if it's worked out at all well, then the line breaks are as imaginative, say, as line breaks ought to be, that they're not just randomly disposed. And so you lift, to some extent, the prose course of the medium into one of the many poetic forms available and take advantage of it. And if advantage is taken well, then perhaps the original letter becomes something more.
I think you definitely just answered my question. You're always drawn to historical figures and historical events. It seems like a humble deference to that which has come before us. Is there any particular kind of when were you just kind of a naturally drawn amateur historian or something?
I wouldn't put it that way.
I guess what I
mean, it would be at a much lower level than amateur.
Okay.
But I did have an excellent AP history class and a pretty good AP world history class, or maybe it was not AP, maybe we didn't have AP world history, but I had a wonderful world history class and a wonderful AP American history class in high school. And when I got to college, what I wanted to major in was American history, concentrating on the Jacksonian period, which I did more or less rigorously for a couple of years, taking other courses as necessary or as dictated. But I began to move off from that, and in my sophomore year, sometime, I guess late in my sophomore year, I took these courses, these grad courses in probability, because I thought I was going to do something in game theory, which was then a hot topic in political science and is a hot topic now, but was not perhaps quite so interesting in the decades in between. And then I, unfortunately, my sophomore year ended with the Cambodia incursion and the student riots and strikes and the deaths of the kids at Kent State. And after that, I didn't really want to be in a major that had much to do with politics. Yeah. So I cashed in and did pretty much what I wanted in my last couple of years.
Yeah. And it's interesting that your, you know, your artistic sensibility really flourishes when you engage history, and I just always find that interesting. Let's move on to page 43, London High Summer.
London High Summer. Trafalgar Square was gray with pigeons. Lord Nelson still erect above the fray, rustier now, lost in his cloudy thought, while tourists dragged themselves below, never meeting eye to eye. All Europe, a heat wave. On the underground, young girls with their bare torsos and effective breasts showed off all they knew, which was just enough, or not enough. They cut the lust with a knife. We were drowning, drowning in fair weather. I'd spent weeks watching the fields yellow with jaundice, the pheasants tiptoe out uncertainly and bargain for grain. That unreliable summer, the tropics sent the old world telegrams. The abandoned trade routes were geometric, rum in this direction. Slaves in that, all for one and one for commerce. The great ships of the line had passed. Out in Greenwich, huge, tilted, overpainted anchors littered the lawns, as if the country had lain too long underwater and could not float.
All right, thanks. That's great. It's such an odd little poem.
If you say so.
Well, it starts off with, you know, just kind of like, well, the tone of it is so kind of measured in the, and then we had the scene with, you know, that they cut the lust with the knife. And I thought it was interesting that there was this kind of hint of the erotic that ends up going into more of a discussion about, you know, kind of old economics and abandoned trade routes, you know, and I just thought that was so, so odd.
I would say the poem is heavily indebted to Lowell. And that lines like too long underwater and could not float or cut the lust with a knife are very Lowell-esque lines. And Lowell has certainly been a major influence for me. And also the combination of culture and violence or art and war lie beneath a lot of his great poems of the 60s.
Yeah. I always go back to Lord Wary's Castle just to tell myself that I'm lazy and that I'm not and that I'm not working hard enough on my poetry.
I hear you.
Because that
I hear
book,
you.
I'm just always stunned by that book. And I do see his austerity and his eye in your work a lot. Do you want to say any more about which Lowell do you kind of gravitate towards? Or are you kind of agnostic about, say, I mean, he was like, what, like 21 or something when he did Lord Wary's Castle?
He was born in 1917, so he was in his early 20s when he did the poems for Land of Unlikeness, which was the private press book that Harry Duncan published. And many of those poems, often heavily rewritten, were part of Lord Wary, which was, I think, 1946. So he was all of 29 when that came out.
That is incredible. It reminds me, I think, of a line that you've written somewhere about barnacles attached to the prow of a ship or something. And that I'm really drawn, and I see it in Cormac McCarthy's fiction, that the eye and physical description can be just render and rupture the very thing that's being described into something else. And I really find that beautiful. And this poem kind of exactly echoes that a lot. So the final poem I'm going to have you read today is on page 43, and it's To the Ghost of an Old Girlfriend. And I want to mention that earlier in the book, there's another poem that references the girlfriend as well, but it's not to the ghost of that girlfriend. Are those poems?
I had a few girlfriends, and
I think that one is to either a girlfriend that's no longer around or dead as well, or I I was just wondering if those poems are, I don't know. I guess there's nothing like premeditated about composing those poems, that they are just the ones that are occurring to you right now in your life. But do you want to say anything about either one of those poems?
The question really is just an extension of the previous question. You know, do I notice anything different about these books? Sure. When I was 25, I didn't have old dead girlfriends. I had very living angry girlfriends, or very living girlfriends who didn't want anything to do with me anymore, like most people. But I probably had three or four major girlfriends. I don't know what the term would be. I was in love with three or four people before I found Deborah.
Yeah.
And two of those people in the course of things died. And I was close enough to them, or to, you know, people who knew them, to learn about it, in one case belatedly. And it's a striking and unhappy moment when you first lose not your aged relatives or even your parents. I mean, that's emotionally much harder.
Right.
But when you lose somebody you were close to who was your age, it's the toll of mortality, among other things, but it's also a sadness that there are things that can't be said.
Definitely. All right. Yeah. Whenever you're ready.
For an old girlfriend long dead. Lying on that blanket, nights on the seventh green, in the dry air, the scent of gasoline, nothing above us but the ragged moon, nothing between but a whispered soon. Well, such was romance in the 70s. Watergate and Cambodia, the public lies, made our love seem somehow more true. Of the few things I wanted then, I needed you. I remember our last arguments, the angry calls, then the long silence, those northern falls, we drifted toward our newly manufactured lives. Does anything else of us survive? That day in Paris, perhaps, when you swore our crummy hotel was all you were looking for. Each cobbled street, each dry baguette, even the worthless sou, nothing you forget. Outside a block away, the endless Seine flowed roughly, then brightly, then nothing. Nothing later went quite that far. I remember that spring, those breaths, that car.
William Logan, thanks for joining me on New Books and Poetry.
John, thanks very much.
You're welcome.